from Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Malaysia court upholds the sodomy conviction of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. Reasons why the West is reluctant to arm Kiev.
You'd have to completely transform their army. You'd have to spend tens of billions of dollars and take on Ukrainian, you know, corruption and, you know, massive poverty. And the West is just not in a mood to do that.
The Zionist Organization of America says the face of anti-Semitism in the world is changing. And a new Cuban opera in New York City. I'm Susan Yawkey. Malaysia's highest court has upheld the sodomy conviction and five-year prison sentence of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim, a decision he, his supporters, and rights groups are condemning as politically motivated. The 67-year-old Anwar maintains his innocence, despite what the court said was overwhelming evidence he sodomized a male campaign aide in 2008. His legal troubles began in 1998 after he was ousted from the ruling United Malays National Organization Party Coalition as Deputy Prime Minister. He served 6 years in prison on separate sodomy and corruption charges before the conviction was thrown out in 2004. Malaysian analyst James Chin of Australia's University of Tasmania tells VOA's Victor Beatty many people thought the High Court would levy a fine but dismiss any jail time.
Many people were under the impression that maybe the courts will give him a certain leeway that will allow him to escape the jail sentence for the simple reason that he is more troublesome inside than outside.
Rights groups are calling this politically motivated.
Yes, I think that is the general impression among the urban people in Kuala Lumpur and Malaysia. And that is the general impression among people outside Malaysia that this was a political show trial.
Is his political career over?
Yes. If he goes to jail, and it looks very likely that he will go to jail, effectively his political career is over. And the reason is very simple. In Malaysia, if you are found guilty of an offense, you are actually disbarred from parliament for a period of 5 years. So he has been found guilty. This means that he will have no political life for the next 5 years.
So will the opposition find a new leader?
The opposition is unlikely to find a new leader because two of the opposition parties, the DAP and Islamic Party, can't seem to get along. It is very likely they'll look for an interim leader, and it is very likely that the interim leader will be Wan Azizah, Anwar's wife. The real issue here is whether they can use Anwar as the number one issue in the next general election. I suspect Anwar will be the number one issue if he's still in prison then. And this will lead to additional sympathy votes for the opposition.
Is the government, the ruling party, going to remain in power, in your view, for a long time? Or do they face a difficult electorate?
That is probably not the right question to ask, for the simple reason that in Malaysia, the electoral system is fixed in such a way that it is almost impossible for the opposition to win. So, for example, the urban areas, which has more than 50% of the population, only returns less than one-third of all the seats in parliament. So as long as the government manipulates the electoral system and control the votes in the rural areas, they will hang on to power.
Chin says with a command of the rural vote, the ruling party of Prime Minister Najib Razak will easily win the next election scheduled in 2018. And he says Mr. Anwar apparently out of the picture, the government may call early elections. In a statement, the government called on all parties to respect the legal process and insisted the judiciary is independent and the case was brought by an individual, not the government. President Obama says his preferred option to resolve the Ukraine crisis is diplomacy, coupled with sanctions aimed at Russia. Mr. Obama, joined by visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel, told reporters during a joint news conference Monday they will await the outcome of a scheduled meeting of European nations with Russia in Minsk Wednesday before deciding whether to supply Kiev with requested lethal defensive weaponry.
I've consulted with not just Angela, but will be consulting with other allies about this issue. It's not based on the idea that Ukraine could defeat a Russian army that was determined. It is rather to see whether or not there are additional things we can do to help Ukraine bolster its defenses in the face of separatist aggression.
For her part, the German chancellor said she sees no military solution to the conflict and repeated her insistence on a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Last week, the German Chancellor and French President François Hollande carried a peace proposal to Moscow, where they met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. That meeting was followed by four-way phone talks that included Ukraine President Petro Poroshenko on Sunday. The quartet agreed to hold face-to-face talks in Minsk. The French press agency says Ukraine needs anti-tank weapons, counter-battery radar, unmanned reconnaissance aircraft, counter-jamming communications equipment, satellite intelligence, and defensive cyber advice. Russia analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver tells my colleague Victor Beatty there are reasons why the West is reluctant to arm Kiev.
The Russians spend between $70 and $80 billion a year, and they're a strategic and tactical nuclear superpower. And the Ukrainians have between $1 and $2 billion worth of weapons. Secondly, we've seen that there's been a serious problem on the Ukrainian side with a number of people deserting the Ukrainian army, which really isn't well organized, where the Russians are much better organized. And finally, Ukraine's gone through a series of political upheavals in the last several years. Whereas Russia has been under the reign of Vladimir Putin since the year 2000, with the exception of Dmitry Medvedev. So there's really imbalance here. And then there's the kind of secret that everybody knows, which is that the Europeans really don't want Ukraine. It's poor. It's $4,000 GNP per capita. Pharmacists make less than $200 a month. And so the reality is, if they were to take this on, together with all their other problems that they've got with Greece and with Spain and with Southern Europe, this would be a staggering blow. So that's one reason that the two leaders, the German leader Angela Merkel and the French leader François Hollande, while they talk tough, on the other hand, they're not acting tough, because they're actually afraid that Ukraine gets dumped in their lap, 46 million people that are largely poor and very poorly organized.
Do you see any hope for the outcome of this meeting Wednesday in Belarus?
Probably not much. Let's face a very unpleasant fact here. The Russians are winning. This is not supposed to happen. And the Russians are winning not only in Ukraine. The Russians are winning in Syria, where their $4.5 billion has really paid off in military aid. The Russians are doing well in Egypt with their $2 billion arms agreement. This is something that has been stunning. In other words, we thought the Russians were finished, and instead, they've made a comeback in the last several years by acting tough. Now, they know where the limit is. They're not all that strong, but they're strong compared to the countries they're competing with.
Russia is standing tough despite sanctions. Are those sanctions beginning to work?
They are. The sanctions are having an impact. And between that and probably a bigger problem for the Russians is the plunge in oil prices. This could be costing the Russians upwards of $100 billion a year. But on the other hand, they're winning. They're winning on the ground. Just in the last few months, they've expanded their territory in Ukraine by 300 to 500 square miles. And if you look at, we tend to forget that in Ukraine, out of 46 million people, there's still 8 million Russians. And there's probably another 8 or 10 million that are sympathetic to Russia. And so in recent polling data from last year, we saw it was like 39-37 between whether they prefer Russia or they prefer Ukraine. And so that's really the core problem. This is very important to Vladimir Putin, and he's very angry right now over something else that didn't get a lot of attention in the West. You know, we just remember the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and this was a very big deal. And guess who wasn't invited? Vladimir Putin, even though it was Red Army troops that liberated Auschwitz. So he is not in a yielding mood right now. He believes that he's got the number of the President of the United States and the key European leaders, and they're talking one way, but they're not acting. In other words, if you want the Ukrainians to win, you'd have to completely transform their army. You'd have to spend tens of billions of dollars, and this is just and take on Ukrainian, you know, corruption and, you know, massive poverty. And the West is just not in a mood to do that.
Edelman says President Vladimir Putin's aggressive policy toward Ukraine remains popular among Russian people with an 84% approval rating in the latest polls. And he says the likely outcome of the crisis will be a partitioning of Ukraine, similar to what happened in Georgia in 2008. The Zionist Organization of America says the face of anti-Semitism in the world is changing. Mort Klein, president of the Israel Advocacy Group, is alarmed by the general trends he sees in the world. We asked how he perceives the sentiment towards Jewish people around the globe in general terms.
Changing in that almost all of the anti-Semitism, the hatred and violence directed toward Jews, both physical violence and verbal attacks and written attacks, are coming from the Islamic community. The vast majority is coming there, and that's something new.
Where was it coming from before?
Before, it came largely from the Christian community, of course. Even the Crusades that President Obama talked about this past week were really attacks on Jews to convert to Christianity, if they didn't convert to Christianity, and frankly, the stop of Islam. That's really what the Crusades were about. So it was mostly a Christian, evolved from Christian attitudes and Christian people. Today, it's all almost all Islamic. And it's quite disconcerting when you have 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, and in almost every poll in the Muslim countries, you're seeing numbers like 90% and higher having anti-Semitic attitudes. The Palestinian Authority, just as one example, 97% of the people of the Palestinian Authority have attitudes which are clearly anti-Semitic. Gigantic numbers that really most people are not aware of.
Is this because Christians are becoming more compassionate, or is it because Islam is becoming more radical?
Well, maybe both. Islam has certainly reared its ugly head to show its face of enmity toward non-Muslims, and the Jews are facing these attacks more than any others. Christians have not become warm and friendly toward Jews as such, but they become less overtly hostile. But this is a very serious problem, and I must say, the world, when we had attacks on Jews in France for the last several years, where Jews were murdered by Muslims, in the six-year suicide bombings in Israel from 2000 to 2006, where 1,500 Jews were murdered by Muslims and 10,000 maimed, you had no rallies against it. You know, here you had appropriately a rally when the Charlie Hebdo people were murdered, this horrible atrocity. You had major rallies and articles all over the world. And yet, as we see, when this was happening to Jews in huge numbers, the world was really silent. So there's still antipathy toward Jews. There's still a hostility toward Jews through the whole world, but not as overt as you find in the Islamic world.
Is this affecting the migration of Jewish people to Israel?
Well, take a look at France. The number of Jews who have moved to Israel from France doubled in 2014, and it's expected to double or triple in 2015. Jews have become afraid for their well-being in many parts of Europe, from England to France, and people are starting to move to Israel just to find a safe haven. Yes, this is clearly affecting the demographic situation. And if the attacks on Jews continue, you're going to see a dramatic increase in Jewish people moving to Israel. Argentina, by the way, is another country. We've had large numbers of Jews moving to Israel because of attacks there.
Mort Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America. For The View from the Islamic World, we spoke with Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. The CARE National Communications Director said, basic Islamic beliefs offer great respect for Judaism and Christianity, and in Islam, Jews and Christians are considered people of the book, meaning followers of an earlier revelation that Muslims believe was finalized by Muhammad. He says Muslims reject anti-Semitism in any form and was the Prophet Muhammad's tradition to Jews in his lifetime. Any rise in anti-Semitism in the Muslim world would be in spite of Islamic beliefs, not because of them, he said.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The dramatic easing of diplomatic and cultural relations between the U.S. and Cuba, initiated by President Obama last December, continues. Recently, excerpts from Cubana Con, the first new opera to be written in Cuba in 50 years, was performed in a New York art gallery for a small group of potential patrons. Such an event would have been almost unthinkable even a year ago. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the opera's American producer, its composer, and its diva.
That's the Cuban soprano Barbara Yanes singing an aria that occurs early on in Cubanacan. The opera follows the fortunes of architect Ricardo Porro, who was commissioned by Fidel Castro to design Cuba's world-famous art schools for the post-revolutionary Cuba of the early 1960s. In this scene, which takes place before the revolution, Selma, Porro's well-placed friend, informs him that dictator Fulgencio Batista's forces know of his support for Castro and tells him he must flee Cuba for his own safety. Charles Koppelman, Cubanacan's American producer and librettist, is proud that this project is being showcased, even in this modest way, in the Big Apple.
I'm thrilled. I'm very excited. I've been developing this opera for 11 years, and I started it because I had to. I needed to. I wanted to. The story had to be told. It wouldn't let go of me. And the fact that time is sort of caught up, and now Cuba is on people's radar, big changes with the United States, makes it a perfect time for this opera, I believe. I was just a little bit ahead of the curve, but I think we're going to see more of these kind of collaborations.
Koppelman says that much of Cuba's vast artistic wealth remains unknown in the U.S.
You would be amazed, not just in opera and music and dance, fine art, you name it. The work is fantastic, and a little of it does get out, and certainly around the world. But I think with the easing, Americans will be able to tune in a little better to what this is all about.
The riches can flow both ways. Through a translator, soprano Barbara Yanes tells the VOA she's excited to be in New York, home of the famed Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, of course, the Metropolitan Opera itself.
To be there at the entrance of a museum and to see all its fabulous works of art from around the world is when you really feel an emotional connection. Of course, I would really love to have the opportunity to see La Bohème, one of my favorite operas at the Met. I think that would be such a wonderful emotional experience.
In the opera's storyline, as in life, things did not work out well for the architect. Many of the art schools got built, but changing Cuban politics prevented several from being completed. In this aria, Selma informs Porro that he is once again out of favor with the authorities. This time it's Castro, and that he must return to exile. Much like Cuban-American relations throughout history, Cubanacan contains tragedy, farce, and beauty. Still, this opera represents an important personal and professional achievement for composer Roberto Valera. At 76, Valera remembers pre-revolutionary Cuba well and has spent his career teaching music at the very art schools that form the dramatic backdrop of the work. Valera is hopeful that art will help the U.S. and Cuba experiment with friendship after their long-time estrangement has failed.
I think it's important that we communicate, speak, and begin to untangle everything that has been tangled for so many years. Music is a universal art, an art that needs no translation. It doesn't matter that at some point we have our differences, because we recognize that. We know to communicate and discuss it, and as a result, we have been able to arrive at favorable conclusions that make our main objective as artists possible, to create beauty.
Cubanacan is scheduled to premiere at the Havana Biennale in May. After the arts festival, producers and stars alike hope it will be invited on a world tour that will include the capitals of Europe, along with China, San Francisco, and New York. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 10th, 1258, Baghdad was overrun by the Mongols, bringing an end to the Abbasid Caliphate. Abbasid caliphs were Arabs descended from one of Muhammad's uncles. During their rule, the Muslim world became an intellectual center for science, philosophy, medicine, and education. In 1355, the St. Scholastica's Day riot broke out in Oxford, England. 63 scholars and as many as 30 citizens were killed in the two-day outbreak of violence. The riot began when two students complained about the quality of drinks at a local tavern. In 1763, the Seven Years' War, a global conflict known in America as the French and Indian War, officially ended with a signing of the Treaty of Paris by France, Britain, and Spain. In 1890, Boris Pasternak, Russian author and poet and a Nobel laureate, was born. In 1898, another literary figure, German poet, playwright, and theater director Bertolt Brecht was born. In 1912, English surgeon Joseph Lister died. Lister pioneered the use of antiseptics and was among the first to advocate sterile surgeries. In 1952, the Congress Party of India won an outright victory in the country's first general election. On this day in 1962, Francis Gary Powers, an American who was shot down over the Soviet Union in 1960 while piloting a CIA spy plane, was released by the Soviets in exchange for the U.S. release of captured Soviet spy Rudolf Abel. In 1996, an IBM computer called Deep Blue became the first computer to win a game of chess against a reigning chess champion, in this case, Garry Kasparov. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terror attack in Paris targeting the staff of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and the beheadings of journalists by ISIL are horrific examples of the extreme dangers faced by journalists today. In an address at a U.S. State Department-sponsored conference aimed at improving security for reporters, Secretary of State John Kerry acknowledged, "There's no way to eliminate the risk completely, except by keeping silent, and that's what we call surrender." Mr. Kerry noted that in the past, the primary threat to journalists consisted of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was rare that a journalist was intentionally targeted. Now, however, journalists are attacked for what they have written, silenced for what they have witnessed, or kidnapped for the leverage their capture may provide. The United States is determined to make freedom of the press an important tenet of its foreign policy goals. Each day, Secretary Kerry said, America's diplomats make clear, either directly to governments or to the public, our firm backing for the right of people to speak, publish, broadcast, blog, tweet, or otherwise express themselves openly and without fear and without retribution. When journalists are unfairly detained, U.S. diplomats raise the issue in meetings with foreign officials at every level, Secretary Kerry said. And that is true whether the journalist is an American or from some other country where the rights of journalists are violated all too often. Moreover, to help bolster the security for local media in difficult situations, the State Department launched a pilot program 2 years ago called SAFE, focusing on digital and physical security, psychosocial care, and the establishment of regional security advisory networks, a program that has now reached some 300 reporters. In addition, with the U.S. Agency for International Development, the State Department has programs that support independent media in more than 40 countries. Despite the threats faced by today's journalists, Secretary Kerry expressed confidence in the future of press freedom and the commitment of journalists to discover and report the truth, even in the face of implacable resistance and grave danger. The United States, he said, will stand with you every step of the way, in all the ways that we have at our disposal.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.